KOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. Dozens are dead, nearly 200 wounded after the Islamic State group's Afghan branch says it bombed the wedding hall in Kabul. The victims of the overnight suicide bombing were mostly members of the minority Shiite Hazara community. President Ashraf Ghani condemned the overnight attack as an inhumane act, saying he has summoned an extraordinary security meeting to review and prevent such security lapses. VOA spoke with Dr. Sumit Gangali, a political science professor and South Asia expert at Indiana University.
This is a colossal tragedy, and it underscores the fact that ISIS has a foothold in Afghanistan, which is deeply disturbing for the entire subcontinent, given the presence of very large Muslim communities in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and even a sizable Muslim community in Sri Lanka. So the ripple effects will be felt throughout the region.
63 people were killed in the attacks. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets Sunday in Hong Kong for another anti-government rally. This is the 11th weekend in a row that protesters turned out to voice their dismay.
We would like to say that Hong Kong people will soldier on until our five demands be heard and responded by the Hong Kong government. And if Beijing's and Hong Kong's tactic is to wait for our campaign to die down, they are simply dead wrong.
The demonstrations began as peaceful protests to stop an extradition bill that would allow criminal suspects to face trial in mainland China. Since then, the protests have evolved into a movement for democratic reforms. Hong Kong residents worry about the erosion of freedoms guaranteed under the one country, two systems that has been in place since the territory's return from British to Chinese rule in 1997. This is VOA News. Several frantic migrants jumped off their Spanish rescue boat into the Mediterranean Sunday. Crew members from the Open Arms vessel jumped in after them and brought them back on board. Open Arms is docked off Italy's Lampedusa Island as a hardline interior minister, Matteo Salvini, refuses to let the ship dock. 107 migrants are on board. More protests in Indian-administered Kashmir on Sunday. Demonstrators took to the street demanding freedom after Indian authorities reimposed restrictions on movement in major parts of the city. The restrictions follow violent overnight clashes between residents and police. In the past 24 hours, there has been a series of protests against New Delhi's August 5th revocation of Jammu and Kashmir state's autonomy. Protester says that no one in the world can stop us from having our freedom. That is our basic right, freedom. The state government has said that it has not imposed a curfew over the past 2 weeks, but on Sunday, people were being turned back at multiple roadblocks set up in the city where security forces said there is a curfew. Secret British government documents are warning of serious disruptions across the country in the event that the UK leaves the European Union without a trade deal. The information is according to a report in the Sunday Times, among the most serious disruptions to the supply of drugs and medicine, a decrease in the availability of fresh food, and even potential fresh water decreases and shortages due to possible interruptions of imported water treatment chemicals. Britain's Cabinet Office did not return a message seeking comment on the documents. But Michael Gove, the minister in charge of no-deal preparations, insisted that the files represented a worst-case scenario, and the document released is old.
It is the case, as everyone knows, that if we do have a no-deal exit, there will inevitably be some disruption, some bumps in the road. That's why we want a deal. But it is also the case that the UK government is far more prepared now than it was in the past.
The scenarios have been repeatedly dismissed as scaremongering by Brexit proponents. U.S. President Trump on Sunday confirmed his interest in buying Greenland, but said it was not a priority.
It's just something we talked about. Denmark essentially owns it. We're very good allies with Denmark. We protect Denmark like we protect large portions of the world. So the concept came up, and I said, certainly I'd be strategically, it's interesting.
Wall Street Journal reported Thursday that Mr. Trump had expressed interest in the self-governing part of Denmark. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today Break Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, August 19th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe police have banned yet another opposition protest, this time in Bulawayo.
What I can say is the business community in Bulawayo has decided to file an urgent court application to stop and bar the protest in Bulawayo.
Linda Masarira is president of the Labour Economist and African Democrats Party. Political violence appears to be on the rise in Liberia's capital, Monrovia. We'll hear from both sides. Civilian members of Sudan's Transitional Sovereign Council have been chosen, and Angola will host a four-nation summit this Wednesday.
According to the statement from the Angolan president, the quadripartite committee will bring together President João Lourenço of Angola, Félix Tshisekedi of Democratic Republic of Congo, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, and Yoweri Museveni of Uganda.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai. And remembering Cameroon's LGBT icon who passed away this month, those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe police have banned yet another opposition protest that was scheduled to take place today, Monday, this time in the city of Bulawayo. The protest had been called by the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, over worsening economic conditions in the country. But a Zimbabwe High Court judge issued a prohibition yesterday, Sunday, upon the request of business leaders and other groups in Bulawayo. Linda Masarira is the president of the Labour Economist and African Democrats Party of Zimbabwe. She said the protest will not revive Zimbabwe's economy.
What I can say is the business community in Bulawayo has decided to file an urgent court application to stop and bar the protest in Bulawayo because of the loss that the UK during the last protest in Bulawayo.
One of the reasons for this protest is supposed to be about the worsening economic conditions in Zimbabwe. So how come you are saying that the business people, as they have petitioned the police so that the protest will not take place?
It is not a secret that in January 2019, business people in Bulawayo suffered a lot of losses from destruction of property. And any business person is cognizant of the fact of protecting their business interests and the jobs of their employees. Rights should not infringe on rights of other people. But when we get to a stage where we want to polarize the political economy in Zimbabwe, we will be doing a great injustice to the business players who also have to make profit of their funds that they've put into their businesses. If the protests were going to destroy the political actors' businesses, then personally, as Linda Masarira, I don't have a problem with that. But when we have protests that affect people with nothing to do with politics, then there is a big problem, and it is a violation of other people's rights, which is also unconstitutional.
Can I say, therefore, that the agenda of your organization is against the protest taking place?
We are very much against it. We actually issued a statement that at this time in juncture, we should actually be mobilizing the unemployed people of Zimbabwe to start engaging in economic development program. And the protest will not produce anything to revive the economy of Zimbabwe. We have to start innovating, start thinking around economic development programs to ensure that Zimbabweans are empowered and that Zimbabwe is open for business for Zimbabweans.
What do you make of the violence that took place last week on Friday? The MDC is accusing police of using violence.
I will be clear about this. On Friday, I was on the ground. I was with my Secretary General and my spokesperson. We went into the street near Africa Unity Square, and what I am saying, I did not see on a video. I saw it with my own two eyes, and I've got witnesses to that effect. That protesters who had been sent to the streets by MDC went and sat in the street, obstructing traffic, obstructing free flow of pedestrians, and that in its own is a crime. This is what I saw with my own two eyes. We have to be factual and real that the MDC has used the ordinary people who are already suffering for their own agenda setting to get donor funds from the Western community. And that has to stop. We are Zimbabweans.
And we cannot continue demonizing our own country so that a few political elites and individuals can pocket donor funds and enjoy lavish lifestyles.
Linda Masarira is the president of the Labour Economists and African Democrats Party of Zimbabwe. She was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. The opposition forces of freedom and change in Sudan on Sunday named 5 civilian members of the Transitional Sovereign Council. This after the group and the military signed the final transitional agreement on Saturday. Dr. Fora Aga is the chair of the Blue Nile Forum, an alliance of 14 political parties and 3 civil society organizations. He says that the civilian members included a woman.
The names are Aisha Musa from the Communist Party, Sadiq Tahor from the Lower Mountains, Hassan Sheikh Idris from the Umma Party, Taha Osman from the Communist Party, Mohammed El Faki from the DUP Party. These are the 5 civilian members whom represent FFC.
So these civilian members, how were they selected? I mean, on what basis were they selected?
As you know, the components of FFC are alliances.
You're talking about the forces of freedom and change.
Yes, FFC is 5 alliances. Select one of their members to represent them. This is why there are 5 now, who are selected from the alliances that design the component of FFC.
Is there any objection to the names that you have called?
Yes, according to my information, there are some guys from the Lower Mountains. They protested that they don't want Sadiq Tahor to represent them in this council.
Why?
They have their local consideration that this guy was not cooperative and he has late relationships with the ex-regime.
What about the military council itself? Have they already named their members?
Yes, the names who are appeared now, Al-Burhan, the chairman of the TMC, is the same person who is going to be the chairman of the council, and Himeti, and Yasser Alata, and Kabashi. These are the military names who are appeared.
The civilian members, when will they be sworn in?
This depends on the civilian names who are going to be raised, and the government itself is also to select the member number 11, who is supposed to be an ex-officer or ex-military.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Aga.
Okay. Thank you for this contribution, and thank you for following up the Sudanese celebration of ending the conflict between FFC and TMC.
Dr. Fora Aga is the chair of the Blue Nile Forum, an alliance of 14 political parties and 3 civil society organizations. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Angola will this Wednesday host a 4-nation summit comprising the presidents of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, and the host, President João Lourenço of Angola. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai says the summit hopes to resolve the ongoing border dispute between Rwanda and Uganda.
According to the statement from the Angolan president, the tradition for the press Saturday, the quadripartite summit will bring together President João Lourenço of Angola, first secretary of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, and the Yoweri Museveni of Uganda.
Mario, so let's take the countries as they relate to one another. Let's take Rwanda and Uganda. There's been problems between the two countries, border problems, closure of borders. Will this be one of the reasons for the meeting?
Yes, yes. Both countries are accusing one another to divide the country. And Mr. Lourenço, since the last July, is trying to mediate the reconciliation between both countries. Rwanda and Uganda reached an understanding after contacts undertaken by Angola with the Democratic Republic of Congo assistance, according to a note of the Civil Office of the President, João Lourenço. The event on the next Wednesday is a follow-up of the 12 July summit also held in Angola, in Rwanda, which brought together the heads of states of the 4 countries, quote, before. So we will expect some kind of, agreement between Uganda and Rwanda to a more quiet relationship and coming down the tensions between the two countries.
Angola at some point was sending back DRC refugees. Would that be one of the reasons for the discussion?
Yes, but this kind of agreement is not being recognized right until now because it must be under the umbrella of the United Nations. So even Angola, which now we have got a peaceful situation across the border, but the United Nations needs to check all these situations. And there are a lot of claims on the public on this kind of situation. What we can expect is some kind of a pre-agreement, not a real agreement. Anyway, it would be some kind of a small victory for President João Lourenço's diplomacy until now.
Mario, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes.
That was veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaevai speaking with us from the Angolan capital, Luanda. Today is Monday, August 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Political violence appears to be on the rise in Liberia's capital, Monrovia. On Saturday, a mob allegedly comprising supporters of the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change attacked Telia Ure, a candidate in the disputed District No. 15 House of Representatives elections. President George Weah has called on the Liberian National Police to investigate. Ms. Ure says the police did not come to her rescue despite repeated calls for help.
Well, this was just another series of the attacks that my campaign has been facing over the past 2 months. Yesterday, I went to visit one of the other candidates in the election office. And while in the office, we started to hear a lot of commotion outside. People were screaming, and next thing you know, people started to throw rocks. Essentially attacked us in the building. We were stuck in there for over an hour and a half. A person actually got in with a knife and came very close to stabbing me. Police were there 20 minutes after the attack started, and nobody was able to intervene to save us, to get us out of there. They destroyed the building completely. About 15 people were injured. My car was completely damaged and burnt. This is similar to what happened at my headquarters about 3 weeks ago when the same supporters of my opponent, Abu Kamara, came and launched these attacks on our state.
Ms. Ure, you are quoted as saying that you didn't think that you would make it. Who do you suspect was responsible for the destruction of your car and the attack on the building in which you were?
Well, the attackers were from the CDC camp, Abu Kamara specifically, and CDC. But, I mean, they don't hide it. They're wearing their T-shirts. They're throwing stones from the office down to where we're, from the house down to where we are.
You said you made calls, but to no avail. Did you make the calls to the police? And what did the police say?
So, while this is not the first or the second incident that the police have been stationed right at where the violence is occurring, and they haven't done anything about it, yesterday, to be specific, we called the police director, we called 102, and the police were standing right outside of there. Actually, when they destroyed my car, 105, who was outside, was asked to please bring his car in to get us out of the office, and he refused because he's not going to use his car to get us out, which I mean the government's car because it's not his personal car. He refused to bring his car in to get us out.
The ruling Congress for Democratic Change or the Coalition for Democratic Change and President George Weah's office have both come out to say that they do not condone the violence that you mentioned, and they're calling for an investigation. Are you satisfied?
I can say that I'm not satisfied because this is not the first time this has happened. Their divisive statements, their hate messages against us, against me specifically, the president got on a podium on June 22nd and said that a jury will never win an election so long as he's the president of Liberia. He also said a lot of terrible things about our family.
Ms. Ure, thank you very much again. We are so happy to have you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, Mr.
Duffy. Telia Ure is a candidate in Liberia's disputed District No. 15 House of Representatives election. She was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. The ruling Coalition for Democratic Change of Liberia, the CDC, has denied that its supporters Saturday attacked Ms. Telia Ure, a candidate in the disputed District No. 15 House of Representatives election. Momba Molu is chairman of the ruling CDC.
The executive committee of the CDC, in the aftermath of allegations of violence in 2015 on both sides, met and issued a statement and condemnation of violence, not only in 2015, but in any part of Nigeria where politics and elections may be taking place. We are an institution frowns on violence and condemn in the strongest possible terms allegations of violence in 2015. And we've called on charities and the Nigerian National Police and the Ministry of Justice to launch an impartial investigation to establish the probable cause and to hold those accountable who will be established as the triggers of violence. The CDC came to power on the platform of change, and we must protect participants of democratic processes irrespective of
Mr. Mulba, I did talk with Ms. Yure. She pointed the finger at supporters of your party. If you said that the CDC does not condone, who do you think might have done that?
Well, it will be improper to pass judgment at this stage. Certainly, we call on the National Police to use this holistic prosecutorial means and deputy mechanism to launch the probe. So we're going to do a comment. We have initial findings, but those findings can only be verified by a proper police investigation or a court ruling. So we are not going to be preempting the outcome of that process. But what we can say, whether members of our party were involved or whether members of opposition parties cooperating in the elections were involved, we can talk about it at all levels, irrespective of which political party or the government being involved.
Mumba Molu is the chairman of the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change of Liberia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. The LGBT activist community in Cameroon lost an icon this month when Mark Lambert Lamba passed away at age 44. The longtime advocate for improved LGBT rights in Cameroon came into his outspoken role in 2005 after he was arrested and imprisoned for a year with 10 other men. Roby Corey Boulay, who recently wrote the book Love Falls on Us, a phrase borrowed from permission from Lamba himself, has written extensively about the LGBT community in Cameroon. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about the lasting legacy of Lamba.
What is especially remarkable about Lambert is that after this trial ended and the men were released, they had endured horrific conditions in the central prison in Yaoundé and were largely left to their own devices as they set about trying to rebuild their lives. Instead of trying to flee the country or trying to hide from this detention that had been forced upon him, he really embraced it and decided that he wasn't going to let this experience prevent him from living openly as a gay man and also trying to establish himself as a resource for other people who faced hardship. So I think when we talk about his legacy, it's really that incredible ability to face down this horrible thing that happened to him and instead of retreating, decide that he's going to embrace a life activism and try to help people who were put into similar situations.
One thing you talk about in your obituary of Lambert is that a younger generation now coming into the activism world in Cameroon and kind of how their approach is different than Lambert's approach. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think the difference in the generations of activists reflects the differences in the landscape that they face. At the time of Lambert's arrest in 2005, alternative sexualities were not something that were discussed in Cameroonian society. I mean, people throw around the word taboo a lot, but it was actually something that was not talked about. There was a lot of denial that existed. And so for that reason, I think it's natural that Lambert and some of the others who came up with him were more confrontational. They had to speak with a louder voice just to prove to people that they existed. Almost 15 years after this happened, well, there are a few people who would make the argument that gay Cameroonians don't exist. Sexual minorities have a seat at the table now. And so they take a softer approach, I think, in their interactions with government officials because they're perhaps concerned about what would happen if they were to lose that seat. But I think the legacy of Lambert is getting them to that point.
You said in your piece that he, quote, wanted to be there when there were were able to shout the first cry of joy that we are free. Obviously, his death is very sad for many reasons, but I think obviously one of them is that he's not going to be able to be there. How much more work is there to do?
Sure. I mean, I think you can look at his record in two ways. There's a lot of emphasis, press coverage of these issues on criminalization and trying to overturn laws that prohibit same-sex sexual acts. On that front, there hasn't been progress. I mean, the law still exists despite many efforts to overturn it. But I think that if we look only at that point, we're limiting ourselves and we're shutting ourselves off to the progress that has been made in terms of ensuring that sexual minorities have access to healthcare, that they have access to housing, that they have networks in place to provide legal resources to them when they are faced with prosecution. I mean, there have been huge strides that were made in Lambert's lifetime and in many cases as a direct result of his work.
That was Robbie Corriboulet. It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Post, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Dakar, Senegal, where the Nigerian women national basketball team, the Tigres, have successfully defended the FIBA Women's Afrobasket title, the one 2 years ago, in a keenly contested final match played on Sunday at the magnificent Dakar Arena, which had as much as 15,000 fans watching. The Nigerian women beat host Senegal 60-55 points to win back-to-back continental title. The Tigres coach is Otis Hugley. Together with his side, they ensured that Nigeria became only the second team to defend their title, having won it in 2003 and defended it at home in Abuja in 2005.
So we knew it would be tough. We played a World Cup team today at home, who was very well coached and very well prepared and not afraid of anything.
Yeah.
And they sensed the moment through experience and through confidence.
Yeah.
And our girls were able to match that. And I'm so excited about that.
The Tigres' Ezinikalu was named the most valuable player of the 2019 FIBA Women's Afrobasket after leading Nigeria to back-to-back continental title.
I'm just happy to go back-to-back with my sisters and my coach here and the staff. I mean, we came a long way. It wasn't easy. The road to getting number one and staying number one is never easy. So I'm happy, we was able to do this again.
Earlier in the day, Mali saw off Mozambique 66-54 to win bronze for the second edition in a row, much to the distress of the Southern Africans who put in a good shift this tournament. In rugby news, South African national rugby teams have been congratulated for a hat-trick of wins by South Africa Rugby. Mark Alexander, president of SA Rugby, said that it's not all the time that you have three national teams playing on the same day and to have all of them victorious. The Springboks overcame Argentina 24-18. The Springbok women defeated Kenya 39-0, and the SA Schools team beat England under 18. 33-26. And now to football. Former Nigerian national team coach Samson Siasia has been banned by FIFA for life following a match-fixing probe. FIFA, in a statement on Friday, said that the adjudicatory chamber of their independent ethics committee found that Siasia was guilty of having accepted bribes in relation to the manipulation of matches in violation of the FIFA Code of Ethics. But the 52-year-old, who has also managed Nigeria under 20 and under 23 teams, has said that he will fight to clear his name. Coach Samson Siasia is, however, not in a rush to appeal against a decision by FIFA to ban him for life and from all football-related activities. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, August 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very productive week.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. Hooray! If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show. I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.